And of course, there's quite a lot of traffic there, but then with different rigs, cars was running too, and I like. And when he got cleared up, so I wanted to go straight ahead. The cop blew his whistle and motioned, signaled to me to come along. They spoke to the old horse, because them steel runners on the sled was sitting on them stones. It started just a little hard. So he went up, put his shoulders in the collar, and he stuck his head up. He said, "No, I can't do this." And I slapped him with the lines, and he wouldn't do anything. And I got out and tried to lead him, and he wouldn't go anywhere. And the cop came down, Mr. Humphrey, I never forgot him. He was a big Irishman, and well, if ever when I was young and down there new and pretty green and bashful, he came down there and he bawled me out in great shape. Coming in there and with a barky horse, and I tried to tell him I didn't know he'd bark, and he said, "Don't try to put that over on me." He said, "You're driving him, you knew he'd bark." And oh, he laid me out. I felt like 15 cents. Well, in the meantime, the streetcar starter got there, and they got a bar under the back of the sled, and they pushed, and I spoke to him, and he felt he'd give a little, and he went it. And the cop informed me, he said, "Don't you ever come back here again." I said, "Don't worry, I won't if I get out of here." Well, I went along. I was pretty embarrassed and kind of mad. So I went home. So that night, on the way home, walking home from work from the Linn Gas Electric plant to come up to Broad Street, and there was a big building there, and in part of it was a harness shop. So I went in, and Mr. Hudson run it, and I went in and I asked him for, he had one of them bow black snake whips, and he said yes. And of course I'd been told that you couldn't lick a horse down in the city if anybody see it, they'd arrest you, see, no matter what happened. So, but I wanted something that didn't show, so I, one of them black snake whips is a little short stock on it covered with leather and a little handle on it, and it's, you could coil it up and put it under your coat and or anything like that, but it had quite a long lash and had a little, quite a lot of sting to it if you took it out and snapped it good. And so I bought it, and I went down the next day morning to go out, and I kept it under my coat, and I put it under the blanket on the seat of the sled, because I didn't want anybody to see it. And those, all those other drivers were driving there. In the meantime, every once in a while when I come in at night, some of the other drivers would say, "Well, how's the old horse going?" I said, "Fine." "Well, you wait till you get a little bare ground and you'll find out." Well, I began to wonder then, because I knew then that when I, after that night, I knew what the trouble was. And I said, "Well, everything's fine." I didn't know that that's the trouble. So I went over and I put 100 bags of coke on, and I had to go to West Linn. So I drove up into the, going up that way, I swung out of my way and went into the freight yard out of West Linn. A lot of tracks, side tracks, that like. I went in there, and of course in between the tracks was cinders, and I drove in between the tracks and wearing you just for parking and that like for cars. Held kind of out of sight, and then stopped him. And then I spoke to him, go, and he leaned in the collar and he said, "No, I can't ever pull this out." So then I got the old thing out and I began to use it in different places, and I'd use it here and there, and he didn't, I never saw a horse that was so tough as he was. He didn't seem to actually, he felt it. I guess he'd been linked enough so his skin was tough anyway. And then I'd look out, see if had anybody coming around, and I'd go back. Well, I tried it, everything. So finally, snapping it across the end of his nose, the tip of his ears, he got on his, and he started up and took a load, and I jumped on and let him go out with it. I said, this ain't gonna cure him. So I put the thing under the cushion, went along about my business. So that night, going home, I took it back with me, and I went into the shop, and I told the fella, I said, "This ain't what I want, can I change it? Have you got a Sandman bit?" He said, "I think so." He said, "I don't get much call for him." He said, "I think I can find one." And so he went looking around in the drawer, and he pulled out a Sandman bit. And a matter of fact, if you make me think of it, I've got it hanging out in the back room, I'll show it to you. I bought that in 22, mm-hmm. And I still got it.
That's nice.
And then I, down in the city, they always, in the bridle, on one side had a little bit of a little snap, so that you could unsnap the bit and take it out of the horse's mouth. So if you come to a water tub, you could take the bit out and he could drink better. And then put the bit back and snap it. So I bought another snap so that I could have two snaps, so I could take a bit out completely and put this one in. And then when I come in at night before I got back, so the other drivers wouldn't see what I had, I could take that bit out, see? And also, using that, you have to have a nose strap. It's a four-ring bit. And so the little strap goes up over the nose, and then the centerpiece goes up in the top of the bridle. So I bought one of those nose strap purpose and the bit. And so the next morning when I got out on the job, I drove up into the freight yard again, and I put that bit in. And then I told Art to go, and he said, no, I can't make it. So I took one rein and just wrapped it around the rein stake in the front of the sled, and took another terrier to step out the side. And that bit, you use it as a thrower, use it like a throwing line, we called it. You take and get back the end of a long rein and start snapping that. And in that bit, in the center of it, there's a link, and on that link is welded in as a big rounded lump of iron, smooth and rounded. It, and with the nose piece over it, holds that lump right up into the roof, right in the roof of the mouth where the wrinkles are. And so if you have a line in the big ring, this is holding up nose, you go out and you start snapping that thing, and then every time you snap it makes that thing come up and bump them in the roof of the mouth. Well, after a few minutes, they don't feel good, I guess. And I used that a few times, and he was surprised. And then he began to get uneasy and think he wanted to go, and I said, whoa! And then I'd snap it. And by and by, after a few minutes, he said, say whoa if you want to, I'm going out. And he got right out and started right out. And I jumped on, picked up the rein, stopped him. I went out and petted him, told him what a good boy he was, turned around and pulled in there again. And he got off right outside of him, and when I spoke to him to go before I give out a couple snaps, and boy, he decided to go out quick. And so, well, make the story kind of short. Then when I got ready to come in at night, I took a bit out and put the other bit in so the other drivers wouldn't notice anything, and the harness hanging up by his stall. And so it ran along quite a while, and I used that a few times, and I didn't have to use it anymore. He'd pull for me every time, no matter when it got so it was snow getting bare and I had to go hard. You get right going hard, you let me jump off and start walking upside of him and speak to him, and boy, I'm telling you, he was moving. And this was what was so funny. He got to the ground down there at the Linn Gat Electric Company, it's all covered with cinders and a lot of steam pipes going through all in the ground. Well, there was snow outside, but out through there by the office and that like was getting pretty thin. So this particular day we got loaded up during noontime. There were two loads of pellet ahead of me with a bulk coke on, and I came out with 100 bags on the sled behind them. Well, when they got out to that bare spot by the office, pretty long this house. So when they got ready to go across there, them other drivers stepped right down on the behind the horse on the whip and took in the reins, and they got down there, and of course they did pull a little hard with a ton on there and the sled. They took in the reins and kept slapping the horse on the tail. They made him go clear out the snow before they stopped. And so one of them pulled out there, went by a little stop, and stopped his horse. Instead of going on, he weighed. Well, luckily, Pat Higgins, my foreman, just came out of the office and see us there. And this other fella, Jim McGrady, had a white horse, and he done the same thing. And when they got across, they stopped. And I don't remember which one hollered back and said, hey, Fuller, you want we should unhitch and help you across? Because they'd tried to drive the old horse in the past, you know, and he wouldn't do anything for them. They knew I was going to be stuck. I said, no, go ahead, I'm all right. Well, they said, we'll wait for you. And my boss was standing there, heard it on the steps with his black overcoat on. So they got across, I spoke to him, we went out, and I got about halfway across, and I said, whoa. And they hollered back, oh, you made a mistake. You should keep him going. You never start now. I said, don't worry. I said, my father always told me if a horse couldn't start a load, he shouldn't be made to pull it. and I let him rest just a minute. I stepped off on the right-hand side of him, and I spoke to him, you know, and he put his old head down. He groaned. And boy, he took that right across just as nice as it could be and got on the snow. I said, whoa. Then Pat spoke up. He said, now I know the troubles are in you damn drivers. He said, you fellas don't know not to drive a horse. He said, it takes a boy from the country to show you how to drive a horse. He said, you all said that horse was barky and everything else. He said, it proved to me that that horse is not barky. He said, here's a young man, he said, from the country come down here, and he hadn't had a minute trouble with that horse. He said, you fellas don't know to drive horse. Go along about your business. Well, them fellas were so mad to think that horse pulled, and so when they got over to put the horse in for dinner, they said, what did you ever do to him? I said, what do you mean, what did you do to him? I said, I don't do anything to him. I never let on what I do. I wouldn't tell him, you know, on a bet. But that old horse would pull every time.
That's a great story.
And then, this is another interesting thing. Later on, got to be springtime, and if we had a surplus of cinders and stuff accumulate, we had a field out there. We used to haul them out. They did, and dump them. And so we had a cart with a horse, you know, the tip cart bought in. You could go and fill it up and drive up onto that pile and dump it, see? So we got quite a big mound of cinders, which we'd use later on when the, you know, the other time when we need them. And his brother John was hauling with the truck. And that's where I had a truck to drive. And John was driving the old Packard. So I had this driving up on this cinder pile, right up quite a ways up, and then go up the top and swing around and dump it all the sides. Old horse would take, going up that hill with a tip cart and a load, it would raise up the collar so that it would pull up against the front of his neck, which isn't good, but the weight back would make the old cart tip up. But he always went up with a full load of cinders on, nice for me, nice could be. So they bought a Ford truck. And so they told me, they said, we're going to put another fella onto your horse. I've hired another fella, and we're going to have you drive the truck to deliver cinders and coke and so on. Better than around the city with a horse and faster. So this new fella took the horse, and he just 2 or 3 days hauled cinders into the pile. One day he got halfway up the ramp, and the old horse said, I guess he's a different driver, I don't want to do it anymore. And he stopped and backed up and tipped the cart over and broke the harness something. And Pat was kind of mad and gave the fella the old Harry, so they told me, and fired him. And the fella said, well, he's balky. He said, you can't tell me he's balky. He said, Fuller drove that horse. He said, all the winter here, he says, and I've seen him pull, and he said, that horse not barky. So they had a little experience with old horse. I never know, never did know what they did with him afterwards. I guess they put him back in the barn and kept him a while. But
oh, that's a great story. Well, you came back up here in 1927.
Right.
And then you were in Rochester until
1936. In 1936, I moved to Randolph.
And that was when you bought your farm?
No. Because I'd spent a lot of years down there driving. Well, I drove a truck for this Higgins, and they later got a big white truck, new one, and I took the old Packard and delivered cinders and belts around. And
delivered what milk?
Cinders.
Cinders.
Oh, yeah. For filling, and then sometimes I had to take that old Packard speedometer, set it, speed set locked at 12 miles an hour, and go way down to Rhode Island, the age of Rhode Island, with 20 barrels of tire.
Oh, my heaven.
And that old thing, hard rubber tires, and when it was empty, it rode like worse than an ox cart. And so, when that bouncing around, like, I probably didn't help my kidneys any, but it didn't bother me too much. Then I came to Rochester, and 2 years I was on that farm, and then John wouldn't rent it anymore, so I moved into Rochester Village and bought a truck after the flood, and I did road work, trucking for 7 years, working in the gravel pit and back on the back road, graveling and putting in culverts and so on and so forth. So I did that. So I was doing road work for 7 years, and 2 years I was on the farm. And during that time, my kidneys got to bother me. And so I went to the doctor, and finally ended up, and he told me I'd get to get out in the truck and I'd be better. And so that's why I moved to, I took a bought out a Raleigh route, because the man was retired and he had run it for years. And I had 9 towns to travel in, peddling Raleigh products from house to house. Of course, I didn't have every house because I didn't all buy, but you know, that's what went around. So that is from 1936, in February 1936, I moved to Randolph. And so I took her out a little earlier than that when I was living in Rochester. But Rochester was way to one end of the road. I had a lot of, when I was way off over in Stratford and Thetford and somewhere there, and then drive home at night, I was still getting a lot of driving. So I decided it'd be more central for my location if I moved to Randolph. So I rented the place that I bought down in Rochester, and I rented a place in Randolph, and that's when I moved to Randolph in 1936. And then I stayed on the Raleigh route to 42, July 1st, 42, and then I bought that farm in 1942. And so I had to give up the Raleigh route after a while. I got so that driving on that was in a car, but I had a lot of, carried a lot of products with me all the time, and loaded, it didn't ride so good, and bad going, that like, got so I was troubled again. And so the doctor says, if you want at your age, if you want to get over it, you'd better quit and get out onto the ground and do, be on the ground and quit it. So that's how I happened to sell out my business there and go and buy a farm. So that's what
and
happened.
How many cows did you have? How big a farm was it?
Well, when I bought it, it was 185 acres more or less. And then I bought part of a farm next to me, so when I sold out, I had 280 acres right around there, I forgot now. And when I bought it, they were only milking 14, 15 cows there. And when I sold out, I was milking 47 to 50 cows. And I built a new stable in 1963, which I probably showed you the picture of.
Yeah.
And so, and you saw the stable finished with the paneling, yeah. So that's.
So you were on the farm for
25 years.
25 years.
Yeah. And so while I was there, of course, then I went to doing more horses' teeth and. Not too many then, because there was a bit on the farm, but did some, and I went and, used to buy a few horses for people and, mm-hmm. and did a little training on the farm and so on and so forth.
Yeah, because one of the things I think that you learn quickly about farming is it's not just farming, it's the extras that bring in a little cash.
That's right. And I was fortunate in 42, times money was pretty short, you know, the war. And when I took older out, money was pretty short and the business was pretty bad. But I, Gertrude, my wife, said, you better do it. And so I got a chance to buy this farm that I liked just through a happenstance. I went there to, I made up my mind, we was looking around for a place, and I went that day to his place, and he had some trouble with his lungs, I don't know, emphysema or something. He couldn't breathe good. He'd been out using a hand seeder, sowing grass seed and stuff. And I went there and he bought fly spray from me, and I just come. So if he wasn't there, around anybody around there, I used to go down the bar and see if his can of spray needed filling, and did it fill it. Next time when I'd tell him about it. So I just come up out of the bar and he came in on the field. And this is funny. He was kind of a nice man, but he was kind of breathing hard. And he said, Mr. Fuller, he says, would you do me a favor? And I said, sure, if I can. He says, I've got to sell this place. Well, that's a coincidence. It never could have been nicer.
Absolutely.
Because I loved that barn, and There's a basement barn and a stable built up, and you drove into the top of it, and a barn shaped just like my dad's barn, the roof and everything. And boy, it made a funny feeling when I woke up, and I says, well, I said, how many acres you got? And he told me, and told me some about it, and then I says, how much you want for it? Well, he was kind of, well, he'd always rub his hands together, and he says, you know, he says, you'll have to come back. He said, I got to talk to my wife. He said, I don't know just what I really want for it. But he said, I got to, my son is here with me, but he don't like farming, and he says, so he says, that's it. So I came home that night, and I said to Gertrude, I says, I found a place we can buy. She said, why is it? And I told her, because she used to once in a while ride with me on a trip. And so I says, I'm going to go back in a day or two and in the evening and see him and get a price. And she said, well, but I don't know too much about it. Well, I said, I know how it looks of being around there. And that, like I said, it's a nice farm, lays good, beautiful barn. House needed a lot of things done to it. And so, we, a couple nights later, after I come home, we drove over and talked with him and went into the house. And when we went into the house, Gertrude, I'm telling you, was kind of sick. Because we just the house we bought, we bought a house in Randolph up near the hospital on South Street, which was being settled estate, and it didn't have a bathroom, and it had just a little bathroom, a half bath, you might say, mm-hmm. No bathtub, but they had a toilet and a bowl. And so while we owned it, during that time on the Raleigh route, you know, these five, six years, we put in a bath, and we also put in a new heating system and fixed the house over a lot and made it kind of nice. And so she went over there, and there was no bathroom at all of any kind. You had to go out across the piazza and into the trip out through the woodshed to go to the outhouse. And they didn't have any hot water in the house. The water ran from the spring into a box in the sink lined with copper, and the overflow from that went down to the barn. And all the water, when they wanted hot water, they had it on top of the cook stove in the kitchen, wood cook stove. That's the way they had the water. And they had a little pantry, just a little pantry place, a little place was narrow with shelves in it and the door. And they didn't have any furnace, they wanted any cellar. Just down to the foot of the stairs, there was a little small corner they dug out to keep potatoes and apples and that like. The rest of the cellar, the dirt was near the bottom. Before I bought it, to make sure the foundation was there, I went over and asked him if I could look it over, and sure, I went over and I took an ice pick. And I went down the cellar and I got on my belly and I crawled around and checked the sills, because the house sat right up on the ground and it looked so that they might be rotten. But they weren't, they were old maples. And so, there was a lot to be done, and no bathroom and no hot water, and the only way the heat they had a big stove in the living room, wood stove in the living room, and then in the kitchen was a kitchen cook stove. I don't know how those people kept warm. The no storm windows or the door that went out on the piazza to go out through to the shed to go to the bathroom. With a wooden panel door, and they had been cracked, and they had it taped up with adhesive tape. Well, it wasn't a very desirable place inside to look at. And so anyway, so I looked around, and he gave me a price, and we came home. And well, Gertrude, we talked it over, and I says, well, it's a good buy. And because I said that barn and all that, and I was buying everything. Is what cattle he had. He had 15 milkers and 7 or 8 heifers and a pair of horses and all the tools, buying, cleaning out everything. Mm-hmm. And I just want to tell you, $6,000 and 185 acres, more or less.
Wow.
And the 38 hurricane ruined the sugar place. It, for the time being, blew over a lot of trees and plugged the roads. So he had a sugar house and an old evaporator. But he told me that, of course, that went with it. But he said, you can't hang on about 300 buckets because the roads are all, well, I wondered why he didn't go and cut them out, and, you know, but he didn't. He wanted, well, he wanted too well. And so that's the story. So I went home, and Gertrude and I talked it over, and I like, and she was awfully nice and accommodating for the benefit of me. She said, well, if we can manage it, she says, we can fix the house up. I said, you're darn right we're going to fix it up. I'll guarantee you we'll fix it up. We're going to have a cellar in there, and we're going to have a furnace. Well, it meant a lot of work, but I was young then. I could do work. And so I went back over, and the next day, after we'd made up our mind, took us about a week to chew this thing over amongst ourselves, and she told me what plans she'd had for where to be if she could be there. So I went back over, and I said to Mr. Sheldon, I says, I think I found a buyer for your place. Oh, goody, goody. He stood there and he rubbed his hands together. He says, anybody that I know? And I says, I think so. I says, I'm interested in myself. Well, he was some surprised. I told him I'd got to get off the riding and get on the land. And so that was the start of it. And then I bought it for $5,500. And we moved there 1st of July. No, yeah, 1st of July in 1942. Gosh. And quick as I got through haying, they had it partly done when I went there, and so I went, took over and got through haying. I said, the first thing we're going to do, I said, we're going to get a fountain to dig out underneath this cellar and have a furnace and have some heat. And so I went on the north side of the house to build up on the bank and wall in there, and I like all dirt. I said, I'm going to dig right out in there and in the cellar well. The neighbor, Mrs. Eddie, her brother, owned that farm at one time. And they lived next door up there. This was funny. When I started digging out there, and right below the house, sometime or other year back, there'd been a building there with a cellar hole. And that right below the house was used for a pasture. And there was that great big hole. So I went in there with one horse and a scraper and started scraping and drawing that dirt out and digging down there and dumping it in that cellar hole, filling that cellar hole up. Well, I'd worked there a couple of days and got into the under the house a piece when Mrs. Eddie came down. And she said, Mr. Fuller, she said, I hate to see you work so hard. She says, so foolishly. I said, what do you mean? Well, she says, you think you're going to put a cellar under this house? And I said, yes. Well, she said, if it had been one put under here, she said, my brother would have put it in here. But she says, you know, it's all ledge up. It was ledge up the other side of the house, on the south side of the house, and ledge up in the pasture and that like, she says. And she says, it's all ledge under here. And she says, you can't get in it. Well, I said, I've got so far. I said, I'm going to keep going till I can't. She says, you waste your money because you're going to strike late. And it was funny. I dug that whole cellar out. And I didn't find any late till I got almost to the cellar stairs that they had for the fruit and potatoes. It was late up in that corner, but the rest of it, I never struck any late at all. Nice. Went in there with the horse and scraped that all out. And then, of course, I hired a fellow to come, and the old stone wall only went down under the sill about 2 foot in dirt. So we set up a form right in front of that, on the dirt, in front of this what wall it was, and filled it with cement right up and covered the cement in those that wall right in, and then went out and leveled it right off to the sill. And you know, that's the only house or building that I ever saw. It was all hand-hewed beams, and it was all maple, hardwood, maple and beech. They don't usually hew They usually use softwood as spruce or hemlock or pine.
That's right.
And them maple, them sills was 12 inches square, hand-hewed, and they were just as hard as iron, I'm telling you. And so, well, that house was built like a barn upstairs. And the upstairs was just one bedroom finished off. The rest of it was all open. But it had posts, and the timbers posts had braces, and it was mortised in with pins like a barn. And it had this purlined plate going, because they're long rafters, and it had these purlined plates under the center of the rafters. Oh, the built strong, being out of the wind and blow, you wouldn't ever, well, you could feel it coming through the cracks, but I mean, the house was so firm, so well built and put together with pins and that like. So I dug that whole cellar out, and then I put in a foundation. The chimney ended on the kitchen floor, and it was a nearly new chimney because the old one got bad, and they put a new one in. My neighbor, Cliff Lyon, a few years before that, put a new chimney in for him. He was a good mason. He was a farmer and neighbor to me for 25 years. And so I said, well, we're going to have a furnace. We got to have a chimney come down in the cellar. So I made a platform and filled it with cement. And I got Cliff to come up and build from that cement block up to the floor and join the chimney together. And when during this time, you get a lot of advice, you start doing something, the neighbors will come in and tell you what you do and you can't do. Several people said you never can join that chimney together because it'll ruin everything else, because you can't hitch them together, but it'll drop down and you'll be in trouble. And well, I said,